Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
This is not about lonely old men or victimless crimes.
A Florida prosecutor outlines criminal charges against the billionaire owner of the New England Patriots. Does it lead back to sex trafficking?
It is evil in our midst.
Will Robert Kraft's winning streak extend to court? Plus, an R&B singer faces the music on charges of underage sex. Also, cameras are suddenly thrown out of court in the case of a Kentucky man accused of murdering a coworker. And a judge writes a scathing order.
In caps, blatant dishonesty.
After a defense blunder, the nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Monday, February 25th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. A lot to talk about tonight, so let's get straight to it. The owner of the New England Patriots is the subject of a low-level Florida warrant tonight. His options? Either surrender or contact law enforcement through an attorney to satisfy the warrant. The warrant itself stems from an investigation in Palm Beach County, which authorities say caught Robert Kraft in a prostitution sting. Court documents say Kraft rolled up to a Jupiter, Florida massage parlor in his Bentley and paid cash for a massage, which he received naked and which was sexual in nature. A detective on the scene says he observed Kraft's arrival and departure and video surveillance equipment installed by police inside pursuant to a warrant captured what happened behind closed doors. Though Kraft is accused of two counts of soliciting prostitution, prosecutors say the investigation revealed sex trafficking.
By the way, it treats its most vulnerable individuals, and that includes victims of human trafficking, which is modern-day slavery. Human trafficking is the business of stealing someone's freedom for profit, including, it could happen anywhere, including in the peaceful community of Jupiter, Florida. In 2017, our office joined with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office and the FBI to help start a human trafficking task force. We're pleased with our progress, but we realize there's a lot more to do. These cases aren't about any one defendant or any group of defendants. The larger picture, which we must all confront, is the cold reality that many prostitutes in cases like this are themselves victims, often lured into this country with promises of a better life, only to be forced to live and work in a sweatshop or a brothel, performing sex acts for strangers. Human trafficking is built on force, fraud, or coercion. It's about time the country has a real conversation about human trafficking, which is modern-day slavery in our midst. This is not about lonely old men or victimless crimes. This is about enabling a network of criminals to traffic women into our country for forced labor and sex.
There's no evidence Kraft knew anything about the alleged sex trafficking. He denies the charges and might not necessarily even have to go in for a mugshot. If he pleads guilty or is convicted, Kraft faces a mandatory 100 hours of community service, a mandatory $5,000 fine, and mandatory classes about the dangers of prostitution and sex trafficking. He could also face 60 days to a year behind bars. Attorneys for R&B singer R. Kelly today entered pleas of not guilty on a series of sex crimes charges against the singer. Kelly stands accused of 10 counts of aggravated sexual abuse in Chicago. The charges stem from accusations of sexual conduct with underage women. Prosecutors say they have Kelly's DNA on a shirt they claim to have been worn by one of the alleged victims. Kelly's attorney says Kelly has turned in his passport but cannot afford a $1 million bail. That's because Kelly also faces other legal issues surrounding unpaid child support and unpaid rent. Chicago police say they have uncovered additional evidence in the case against actor Jussie Smollett. Smollett is accused of faking a racially charged and homophobic attack, which he claims happened to him. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson told ABC News today that his department has physical evidence, video evidence, and testimony to back up their case against Smollett. The superintendent did not go into detail. Over the weekend, ABC News obtained and published a $3,500 check from Smollett to one of the two men who claim Smollett paid them to attack him. Day three of testimony in the trial of a Kentucky janitor accused of murdering his coworker. David Dooley is facing his second trial regarding the death of Michelle Mockby. The lead investigator who worked the case was having an affair with the prosecutor who handled the first trial. That first prosecutor also failed to turn a surveillance video over to the defense. A new prosecutor is now in office. Dooley and his wife both worked at the facility where the victim died. The state says the motive was that Dooley's wife was submitting time cards for time she did not work. Fearing Mockby would put an end to it, the state says Dooley killed her. Today, the medical examiner testified that it is likely the victim was dragged along the floor with her arms taped behind her back.
If we look at these injuries that we have, there is a series of events that explain them. If your hands are tied behind you, in this case with tape, you don't have much mobility, okay? Our eyes are out front, so our limbs work this way out front of us. They don't work too well when they're behind us. As a matter of fact, you're usually sort of stretching things when you're doing that kind of a posture. May I stand for a minute, Your Honor?
You may.
So if my hands are behind my back, I've really limited the amount of motion my upper arms can do. Okay. So if someone were to try to carry me or drag me along by my arm, I'm getting a lot of carrying my weight, someone's pulling or tugging on me. I don't really have much room there. It's taking a lot of load. So you could break your arm, right? And as you're being dragged by your right arm, what feet are going to be going in contact with the floor? Well, it's going to be on the left side. Your left foot is going to be in more contact with the floor. So you're going to get more abrasions on your left foot and more dirt, because your right foot is going to be more elevated because you're being picked up by your right arm, okay? And then while you're doing that, you're going to have your abdomen pressed out more. Remember, hands are tied together and they're pulling on it. So your abdomen is going to be projecting. So if you're dropped on the floor, your liver gets bruised. So that's how, and also you have some injuries on the face. That's how a simple explanation how we can incorporate those injuries into a simple series of events.
Michelle Mockby suffered a series of injuries that had nothing to do with being dragged. Here, the medical examiner tries to make sense of what was likely the weapon.
Did you prepare a report?
Yes, sir, I did.
Your conclusion? And what was your conclusion in that report?
Cause of death was blunt force injuries to the head.
Okay, did you make any finding when you prepared your report regarding what was used or what could have been used?
I made it in the summary what I described, and I said there were sharp force injuries to the head, neck, and extremities. There were blunt force injuries to the head. Blunt force injuries were also seen in the right arm and the humerus fracture. The injury pattern suggests two weapons. One with a sharp surface, the other with a blunt surface, or one single weapon with both sharp and blunt surfaces.
Do you recognize that?
Yes, sir.
What is that?
This is a pretty rugged here, tape dispenser. And the areas I was looking at are the linear areas, or line-like, and semicircular areas. So in other words, these kind of impacts. Now the other one I told you, I saw, thought it looked like it might be a corner. Plenty of corners on here. Plenty of corners. So we have both linear and we have semicircular and we have corners. So it satisfies the patterns that we have. And that's why I said it could have made injuries. It's consistent.
Earlier in this case, the 911 call when coworkers discovered Mockby's body.
And I just walked in her office and I think somebody had killed somebody upstairs in her office.
Okay. What makes you think somebody killed somebody?
She's laying there on the ground, covered up, and there's blood all over up the floor in the office.
Okay. What's the address, sir?
7383 Empire Drive.
Okay. Is it somebody that worked there? Or?
Yeah, it looks like her name is Michelle Maccabee. She usually comes in early on Mondays. And they got her, like, her whole body's covered with plastic and that. So you can't see her head or anything.
And it is obvious she's dead, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. How long has it been since somebody was in there?
5 o'clock, we have people come in. Usually Michelle on Mondays gets here at 7 o'clock.
Okay. So there were people there yesterday?
No, nobody was in here yesterday at all.
Okay, so this morning, and so the last time somebody would have been there would have been last Friday?
Friday, yeah, Nate would have left around 8 o'clock at night.
Was that her office?
No, she's on the outside. We have a mezzanine. Well, the blood is right by her office door. It looks like she never got in her office.
So she couldn't have jumped?
No, ma'am.
Hands tied behind her back?
I think she's no shoes on. Like you said, and somebody covered her body with plastic or something.
Okay, and you said there's blood outside the office door?
Yes, ma'am. A big pile of blood.
A major with the local sheriff's department said he had to separate witnesses for interviews not long after that 911 call. And when he tried to separate people, the defendant was behaving strangely.
You want people to be able to give their statement based on what they remember, what they recollect.
And not what the group thinks, right?
Correct.
Okay, so who were the people that you decided needed to be separated?
One was Ed.
Why Ed, by the way?
Ed made the statement that he had seen the spot and then had further investigated because he made the statement that they didn't know if somebody had cut themselves on the floor. It's a packaging company. Once they saw that red spot that was on the floor in that hallway on the upper level, him and the maintenance, then they basically started to investigate further, and that's when they came across the victim.
Okay, so that's why we separate Ed.
Yes.
Who else did you separate from the group?
The gentleman that was listed as maintenance, he was separated, and then there was a third, David Dooley, was listed as a janitor.
You made the decision to separate these three people out, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And David Dooley was one of those three, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Let me ask you, were there any observations that you made of Mr. Dooley when you asked that he be separated from the rest of the group?
Mr. Dooley acted resistant at first. He didn't appear to want to leave the rest of the group of employees that were gathering again in that front lobby area.
This afternoon, the judge shut down television coverage of the case, citing so-called unspecified concerns from attorneys about video and audio recording. We'll wait and see how that shakes out. Joining me now is attorney Marnie Jo Snyder to talk about this case. Marnie Jo, let me ask about this. So we've got this surveillance video. We have the defendant coming and going on the morning that the body was discovered. The prosecution says he was making conflicting statements and he left the premises, possibly to hide evidence. The defense says the timeline doesn't add up, though. What do you make of it?
I think that's really important. I kind of sometimes refer to it as sort of an alibi. When you just can't have certain actions that the prosecution alleged take place in the time frame that they say they took place or the way that they said it happened. And so I think it's really important for them to kind of flush that out, all the different times that they're saying, and to show that part of the story is impossible. Certainly that would raise a reasonable doubt, at least as to the fact that they're trying to prove him moving about in the time frame and committing the murder.
Yeah, kind of a curious little theory here that this tape gun was the one object that caused all the various injuries on the victim's body. Sounds like good police work, good medical examiner work.
Well, it is very interesting. What they're saying is that it doesn't make a lot of sense that someone would have changed items, right, while they were committing this murder, especially not if they want Mr. Dooley, who was doing this in anger and retaliation, to be the person that's doing it. So they needed to find an item that had all those things. And if that item was on scene, it makes a lot of sense. It has corners, sharp edges and duller sides to it, and certainly is heavy enough to bludgeon someone with.
And now the jurors have that visual image of the medical examiner sitting up there and using the weapon, perhaps as it was actually used to commit the murder. Marty Jo Snyder will check in again with you in a moment. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a jury's been selected to hear the case of a former cop accused of gunning down a stranded motorist. Plus, the defense fails to turn over a critical piece of evidence in a Florida murder case. The state says it can't tell if it's even real. The judge snaps back. We're back in the courtroom after the break. Opening statements are scheduled tomorrow in the trial of a former Florida cop accused of killing a stranded motorist. Ex-police officer Newman Raja is charged with the 2015 shooting death of Corey Jones. Jones was stranded on the side of I-95 near Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Raja fatally shot him and claimed he was defending himself. However, the victim had called 911, and a 911 recording the officer didn't know about tells a very different story. We expect that case to pick up tomorrow. Day four of a Florida murder trial involving the death of a mother of three. David Russell Holbrook Jr. is charged with murder after Melissa Howard's daughter found her stabbed and beaten back in 2006. The victim had just won a child custody battle against her ex-husband, Brian Howard. The defendant was Brian's friend, and the ex-husband himself was at a large party and has an alibi for the time of the killing. An expert testified that Holbrook's DNA matched male DNA found on Howard's blood-soaked sweatshirt. But that expert also admitted she contaminated the evidence. Analyst Jennifer Halter told the jury she mistakenly used scissors from a sexual assault case to cut a piece of the shirt worn by the victim. That resulted in DNA from the sex assault transferring to this case. Here are some of the results and some of the cross-examination.
When you compared B20E to Russell Holbrook's standard, were you able to draw a conclusion?
Yes. Again, the sample had a mixture, and I assumed that Melissa Howard was a contributor, and that the partial foreign DNA profile matched the DNA profile from David Russell Holbrook. I did have other limited information that was observed in the sample that may suggest the possibility of an additional contributor. For the nine genetic markers, the frequency of occurrence of the partial DNA profile for unrelated individuals is 1 in 39 million.
You brought more DNA over from a pair of scissors that made a cutting that may or may not have been cleaned. Given not cleaned properly, and y'all came up with a new procedure for cleaning scissors because of this you described.
Yes.
Is that right? So you brought more DNA over from a pair of scissors from a cutting into this sweatshirt than all of that foreign DNA that we've been talking about today. Is that correct?
Yes.
The defense apparently plans to call an expert to testify that the DNA does not match Holbrook. Also today, the prosecution played surveillance recordings of the defendant entering and walking through a Walmart store. The state claims the defendant left a birthday party, dropped his kids off at 9 o'clock, called his girlfriend at 9:29, and went to Walmart at 9:37. The state asked jurors to zero in on that time frame between 9 o'clock and 9:29, just before these recordings. That's when the state thinks the murder occurred. So the state is saying these recordings show someone who just killed a mother. Back during opening statements, the defense said the timeline does not add up.
Went to Walmart, came back home, all wearing the same clothing. No one's frazzled. No one looks any different. No blood. There's nothing on these individuals that would indicate that that Russell had been in any gruesome murder during that time frame, during this timeline. It's going to be very difficult, I believe, and I think the evidence will show it will be very difficult to have done this so-called murder. Just didn't have the opportunity. There's problems. Not enough time. Just not enough time to have done that.
Late today, the defense tried to enter an email it has known about for several years, but never gave to the prosecution. The state objected to this whole thing, saying all discovery on both sides needed to be turned over under an order from the judge. Not only that, but the contents might have been fake. Let's start with the state.
Say if a fake header was written above it, where it says text message, and it does say in parentheses, this
when
is not
original. When you say fake, does the word false come to your mind? That's what comes to my mind, and I'm going to get an explanation on that.
Yes, Judge, this is not the original. It says it's not original. It says, from Megan Palumbo to Darlene Cooper, date December 6, 2016. It's in the format of an email.
But it's not the email, is it?
No, Judge, and it's not a text message.
Mr. Warren, what is it?
I had to type that up.
We have a transcript of that?
Yes, Your Honor.
It better say that. I want to know why the state wasn't provided that until 6:41 last night. I want the truth. We've been dodging it many times. I want it right now.
It wasn't intentional, Your Honor. I really wasn't.
Don't try. No, you don't get to try again. Tell me the truth. How long have you been practicing law, Mr. Warwick?
12 years.
I've been doing it 33. This is as bad as I've seen. To my left is Mr. Holbrook, who deserves better than this. Not from you, but from the guy sitting next to him. I will craft a result based on, in caps, blatant dishonesty. I'll see counsel in chambers right now. Tell the jury it'll be a little while. We're in recess.
Again to attorney Marnie Jo Snyder. So Marnie Jo, look, a lot of issues wrapped up together here. Contents are unclear. The possibility that this document was somehow doctored, and it's all wrapped up in a defense duty to turn things over to the state. Normally that's the other way around. The state has a constitutional duty to hand things over to the defense. So how do we unwrap this?
So some things were very confusing. Apparently under Florida law, the defense does have an obligation to turn over any tangible objects that they might have. And that also can include tangible objects and documents before trial. They just have a different process of discovery than many other jurisdictions where I've practiced. So it does look like they violated that procedure. Certainly, though, the judge has to be aware that there is a fairness element to the defendant at all times that they have to pay attention to. And so the judge really has to decide, you know, is it equitable to allow this evidence in without it having been turned over before? And this is a very serious case. So it could lead to appellate issues later on.
Yeah, they don't want to cause issues here because, look, I mean, you've got to give a defendant a right to defend himself. So Marnie Jo Snyder, appreciate your insights here on The Debrief. And thanks to those of you watching. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock. On the Law and Crime Network. That's Eastern Time. Live trial coverage begins at 9 in the morning.